You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Every once in a great while, a genuine murder mystery unfolds before the eyes of the American public. The tragic story of Susan Powell and her murdered boys, Charlie and Braden, is the only case that rivals the JonBenet Ramsey saga in the annals of true crime. When the pretty blonde Utah mother went missing in December of 2009, the media was swept up in the story, with lenses and microphones trained on Susan's husband, Josh. He said he had no idea what happened to his young wife and that he and the boys had been camping in the middle of a snowstorm. Over the next 3 years, bombshell by bombshell, the story would reveal more shocking secrets. Josh's father, Steve, who was sexually obsessed with Susan, would ultimately be convicted of unspeakable perversion. Josh's brother, Michael, would commit suicide. And in the most stunning event of them all, Josh Powell would murder his two little boys and kill himself with brutality beyond belief. It will be 11 years, December 6th, since Susan Cox Powell disappeared. Her story is still unfolding. A definitive update on the case will air on ABC's 2020 on Friday, November the 6th. The New York City crew came to Seattle in early March to interview Rebecca just as the city was locking down for COVID. The crew was there for the very important court trial involving the Washington State Department of Health and Human Services and the responsibility in the deaths of Charlie and Braden. There are other events happening this week that could postpone the airing of the 2020 program, November 6th. The book that we're featuring this evening is If I Can't Have You, Update, Susan Powell, Her Mysterious Disappearance, and the Murder of Her Children, with my special guest journalist and author, Rebecca Morris. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Rebecca Morris.
Hi, Dan. So great to be with you again.
Thank you so much. It's always great to have you, and considering the developments in this case, we felt it important that people revisit this case once again. And thank you so much for coming on and talking about it. Let's talk about just some of the things that I alluded to about ABC's 2020 on Friday. Tell us a little bit about your interaction with ABC, and before we talk about the court case, the court trial that they were in town in Seattle for to cover. So let's talk about your experience with ABC's 2020.
So the Susan Cox Powell case, and somewhere in the last few years, the family decided to start using, you know, put her maiden name in there, because especially trying to distance themselves from the Powell. So these days she's called Susan Cox Powell. And the case has really never been, you know, out of the public eye or away from the media much, because as you explained, over this 11 years, I mean, this is a story that just keeps unfolding, and, you know, we don't even know if we're, you know, if there's an end to it now. So it's been the topic of television shows before, the Investigation Discovery Channel and HLN, and, you know, I've been interviewed before with other production companies who have done other things, and it's been it was a podcast in the last year from Salt Lake City television station. But you know, 2020's done some of the best coverage over the years, and they wanted to revisit it. And this was, of course, all the planning was, you know, before COVID. But I've worked with 2020 before on a Ted Bundy program a year or two ago. So, I mean, it was interesting because they came to Seattle, I mean, literally, must have been the last plane in and out. of Seattle before COVID, because it was very early March. And as usual, as production crews and networks do, they rented a space, you know, downtown Seattle, a big loft where, you know, we could set up. The city was already dead. I mean, you know, we couldn't even find a restaurant to have a meal at. And, you know, they just are really professional to work with. And they were also obviously interviewing many, many other people. I'm sure I'm just a tiny part of this, but they always talked to the, you know, Susan's parents and attorney Ann Bremner, and I'm sure people in Utah. And one of the things about, you know, both books and television shows is you have to find something new to say, because it's been done before. But I think, you know, this was timed to coincide with the court case. The same producer that came out from 2020 had been here the week or two before to attend the jury trial on the wrongful death suit that we're going to talk about. And then that trial was interrupted because of COVID. But now we have a decision in that. So it was just a kind of odd time. I was scheduled to do other TV programs in the spring, and everything mostly got postponed. I was interviewed for two programs on other stories where they hired a local crew in Seattle, and, you know, we sat in a conference room, everybody wore a mask, there were just two crew people and me, and the producer was on the other end of a cell phone asking questions or on Zoom. So just, you know, it was possible to still produce programs during COVID, but, you know, crews couldn't travel. And it was just, it's, you know, just one of, of course, millions of small things that have been affected by the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Now, we talked about or mentioned the Washington State Department of Health and Human Services. Tell us what was the heart of this in terms of what were the issues that were addressed at this, and what was the result? And, of course, this is what the media was also interested in, part of the news part of this story.
The newest part of the story is this wrongful death suit, and I've updated it also in the book, If I Can't Have You. It's funny, every year there's been an update to the back of the book because so many things have happened. Mm-hmm. This was brought because, of course, there was never an arrest in Susan Cox Powell's disappearance. Her husband, a suspect, a person of interest, was never charged. Nobody was ever charged. And I learned a lot the last couple of years about what are literally called no-body cases. A no-body case is when there's no body found, and Susan's never been found. It often means that prosecutors don't bring charges, because the best way of getting a conviction is if you have the evidence, you know, from a body being found. So without that, you know, attorneys sometimes, you know, have to get creative. And Ann Bremner, a Seattle attorney who's worked on a lot of cases over the years, usually bringing charges for families that the prosecutors don't bring. And she, one of the only things they could try to do to you know, find justice was to, Josh Powell's not around to be able to charge him with anything. So they made, frankly, what I think is a very good case against the state of Washington for when Susan's sons, Charlie and Braden, were in protective custody. So as you know, after Susan disappeared, Josh, you know, very quickly, within a week, packed up his home. You'd think he'd stay and look for your wife, but he didn't. Mm-hmm. He packed up his house, and the kids moved to his father's in Puyallup, Washington, where they grew up. And then you had two states involved in trying to keep track of this man and his family, because Washington State was still now had some responsibilities, because the children eventually were in custodial care, and while Utah was still conducting an investigation of Susan's disappearance. While, you know, I saw all the records, and it was really, I don't know if I've ever been so shocked as when I read those records about what Charlie and Braden, the lives they led that last couple of years of their life. As I think we've talked about on this program before,
sure.
They were taken from Josh's custody when his father, Steve, who you mentioned, was charged with both pornography and voyeurism. So they were taken from the house. They were temporarily placed with their grandparents, Susan's parents, as foster parents. So they were under now the protection of the Department of Health and Human Services in Washington State, or what's commonly called CPS, Child Protective Services. Josh still had visitation with them twice a week, which was lax. I think it'd be fair to call it that. And the protection they did or didn't get during the last year and a half of their life is what was at question here, and what was the basis for the wrongful death suit. And if you'd like me to explain the details of what that was, I can go into detail.
Absolutely. I'll go ahead and do that,
okay,
please.
Well, they... there was, of course, a caseworker who was always accompanied. You know, she drove the boys to and from their visitations with Josh. Because Josh was so much in the news, the other parents at the building where he usually would have had his custody visits, so there would have been some security, some staff around, you know, other parents coming and going to see their children.
Right.
The parents didn't want him having his visitations there. He was just very strange. So he was allowed to have one of his visitations every week at the home of a minister who lived across the street from Josh's father, Steve, who, you know, had taken an interest in the family and was mm-hmm. trying to help Josh. So visitations were there, and then along the way, the state decided that a second visitation during the week Josh could have at this rental home. Josh had rented a house not far from his father's house, empty, put, you know, a few sticks of furniture in it, and was basically pretending to live there. And the boys would have one of their visits there. And that's where they died ultimately, because they raced ahead of the caseworker that day, February 12th, 2012, and he shut the door in her face. But what I found out when I looked at, fortunately in time when I was rewriting the book, is that... the boys had physical exams as part of their, you know, being in protective custody. They had strange rashes on their body. They told their grandfather that Josh slept nude with them. They were obviously in a house. Well, they were in a house that where their grandfather Steve Powell was producing an enormous trove of pornography and voyeurism. And you know, who knows what they were exposed to in that sense. The boys, once they went to live with their grandparents, Chuck found them once they were, you know, taking a bath together. They were 4 and 6 years old at the time, and one was trying to drown the other in the bathtub,
right.
And Chuck said it was not a game. It was not a game. Something had so damaged those boys between the day their mother disappeared in 2009 and when they died in 2012. Just, you know, they had really been damaged and most likely molested living with their father and grandfather. They drew pictures of, I think it was Braden, who was the youngest, drew a picture of, you know, telling an adult to stay away from him and not to mess with him. They also were remembering some things about the last night, you know, of their mother's life. Josh had always said, you know, he took the boys camping. Winter camping is it's a real thing in Utah, even if it's, you know, below freezing and there's a blizzard, and that he left Susan at home. The boys said, and they drew pictures, that their mother was sleeping in the back of the van and that they left her out, you know, in the desert with the crystals, with the rocks. The boys were really interested in looking at rocks and things. And so they were remembering more, but they were, you know, physically and emotionally they acted out, you know, a lot after their mother died. And, you know, they were so fortunate to have the love of Judy and Chuck Cox those last couple of years. But they had definitely been harmed, and that was the basis of the wrongful death suit. And again, this is one of very few paths that a family can take if criminal charges are never brought against somebody. And
right.
So that was the basis of the lawsuit, and the fact that, you know, Chuck Cox, who by his career was, he was a FAA crash investigator. He knew about investigations. He knew about burned bodies. You know, he knew this stuff and was very proactive. And he warned, especially Utah police, but warned CPS in Washington State for many, many months that Josh was going to hurt those boys, and nobody believed him.
Right.
So when they finally brought their first attempt at bringing a wrongful death suit was dismissed by a lower court, but finally it was able to proceed. And what I thought was really fascinating, and I don't know if this happens with other cases, but Ann Bremner and her team were able to point to how many seconds Charlie and Braden suffered once their father closed that door on the caseworker. And they asked for a certain, you know, dollar amount for every minute that each boy suffered, because we know from evidence at the scene that the first thing, well, Josh had prepared for this. He'd bought cans of gasoline. He'd given away things. He'd sent, you know, texts and emails saying goodbye. He'd emptied his bank account. He had an axe, and he was prepared for when those boys came that Sunday afternoon, Super Bowl Sunday 2012. He shut the door on the caseworker. He struck both boys in the head with an axe. He poured gasoline on them and himself, and the house exploded. And they could figure out how many, you know, I believe it was 7 minutes that those boys suffered before they died. And so the reward amount for the suit was tied to that. The jury trial here in Pierce County, Washington, was interrupted by COVID. There was some discussion about, gosh, do they just start all over, or do they get a different jury, or, you know, do they reach some tentative settlement? But everybody really wanted to continue the trial, so it picked up months later. And I'm sure the video of that is on YouTube. You know, everybody, it's just the Cox who's there, and the attorneys and the judge, and everybody's masked, and it's like another world to see a trial going on during COVID. And they had some witnesses, and the jury awarded more than anybody predicted, more than was being asked. They awarded $98 million to the family.
Wow.
Now, that's been appealed, and even the judge in that case couldn't believe that it was such a big award. And it's been cut in by two-thirds, so I believe it's $38 million now. But basically, the state of Washington has a jury agreed that those boys their lives could have been saved and weren't. And I think it's such an important message for other states and other courts, Dan.
Yes. Let's use this as an opportunity just to stop for a second for these messages. We talked about this incredible jury settlement or the recommended settlement and $38 million. So incredible validation of what had happened and their responsibility, Washington State Department of Health and Human Services. What's very, very interesting out of that is the court case that was the impetus in the court, in the custody battle. Josh believed that he could gain custody of his children wrongfully, but there was conditions for him to try to gain custody of his children, and that was this psychosexual examination. Tell us about this reason for this and what this effect of this evaluation and its result and the court case result and what you believe and Chuck believed was the result of this court decision.
That was that led to Josh's, you know, terrible decision to kill the children and himself. Let me make one quick correction. A judge reduced the award to $32.8 million. And from $98 million, the decision that led to that seemed to make Josh feel cornered. He had been optimistic that he was going to win custody, but I don't, you know, he never would have. There'd been
sure,
but the last minute sort of turn of events that led to all this is that at the last minute, you know, during this custody hearing, when he and the Coxes were fighting for custody of the boys, the Utah investigators had informed the attorneys in Washington State, the state, actually arguing for the Coxes, that child pornography had been found on Josh's computer in Utah that had been there at the time Susan disappeared. And
Right. There's
probably a lot more on that computer they've still never been able to, you know, break through all the firewalls and all the coding and everything. But they'd found some kind of child pornography. And if Washington State had known that, you know, Utah had known that for, you know, 2 or 3 years, it's just inconceivable they didn't share that information while this was going on. But they told the attorneys this in February 2012. And that, you know, put some new conditions on Josh. And he was, I think he was terribly, terribly angry and frustrated by that. He'd gone into court on that very day, feeling very optimistic, telling people, you know, that he felt really optimistic. He was going to go home with his children that day. And then what he hears is that, nope, you know, there are some conditions you have to meet. And one is, because we know now about your computer, you're going to have what is called a psychosexual exam. So that is, besides a more in-depth psychological exam, a psychosexual exam is when, and I suppose there must be a way to give one to a female defendant, I don't know, but with a male defendant, their, you know, penile response is measured when they are shown different pornographic images.
Right.
And he was, you know, very, that seemed to be the tipping point. And Chuck Cox told everybody, this, you know, this is not good. I'm really worried about Josh now. And so within day, Josh had begun, he'd planned. I don't think he planned this before. I think that's very much the thing that got him thinking about, well, the only thing he could do to get even. I mean, he really, you know, hated Susan's parents, hated the Mormon church, which, you know, Susan had, was still a member of, and the Coxes were members of, and he'd grown up in the church but had left it. He just had so much hate in him, and he planned this without, as far as we know, without telling anybody. And it meant, again, you know, paying some bills, cleaning out his bank account, leaving instructions with a couple of people about, you know, what needed to be done, taking things to a storage area, you know, giving away the kids' toys. If somebody had been watching him, they might have, but nobody was watching him. And that, you know, it reminds me so much of after Susan disappeared and he was still in Utah for a couple of weeks and then moving to Washington State, they didn't seem to be watching him or trailing him or, you know, this is backtracking a bit, but a day after Susan disappeared, you know, and they'd taken his van to search. And, you know, he went to the Salt Lake City airport and rented a car and was missing for, right, you know, 24 hours. I mean, nobody was really keeping tabs on him. You know, Chuck told me, you know, a lot of things one day. I mean, he used to, when he knew the caseworker had picked up the boys, you know, and taken them to this house that was Josh was renting, you know, Chuck wasn't supposed to be anywhere near it, but he might, you know, drive by to, mm-hmm, kind of see that everything was, you know, as should be. But I think it was the psychosexual exam that got, you know, really put Josh in a corner. And Chuck told everybody, you know, this is it. Josh is really cornered now. Josh does not behave well when he's cornered. And he plotted this murder-suicide. And, you know, I don't think that he, as far as I know, he didn't. He sent a couple texts that could be interpreted as goodbyes to his attorney and to his sister, and that was pretty much it.
What about one of the most amazing, vivid, and horrifying scenes that pops up when you read this is about Elizabeth Griffin Hall, the social worker that is the person that delivers the children to these visits.
Gosh.
And you describe that and that day that she drops those kids off. But also, just before that, there is talk of a surprise. She
oh
hears
gosh,
that as
yeah.
well, and the Coxes hear about this surprise. Tell us about this surprise, and before we talk about the actual horrifying day when Griffith Hall goes and delivers these kids, and tell us about that.
Well, you know, I think about her a lot, probably as much as I think about, you know, Susan and the Coxes and the boys. I believe for many years I was the only interview she gave.
Mm.
And it was probably, you know, like a year after the event. I think she's done, you know, one or two other interviews now. But, you know, she is just, you know, just in a terrible situation. The surprise was, you know, she arrived with the boys, and as they ran ahead of her, you know how children are, they ran up mm-hmm. the sidewalk to the front door of the house, and Josh was there with the door open, and he greeted them, and before she could get in, he shut the door in her face. But she heard him say, "Charlie, I've got a surprise for you." And, you know, does that mean I'm going to murder you? Or, you know, who knows what he meant? But it's chilling when you know of that, you know, it's later. It's just chilling. I've got a surprise for you. And one of the next things, she could smell gasoline. And, you know, she had formed a real bond with these kids. And just in those, you know, several minutes, a couple of times a week, where she would drive them and be present. And, you know, it's just a horrendous experience for her, and
when she does go to the door, you I know it's hard to talk about it, but the exchange between her and Josh is just remarkable, and I think if you could give us that exchange, because it's absolutely amazing when she calls 911 and
oh
the frustration,
gosh, yeah.
excruciating
yeah.
7 minutes. So please
yeah.
tell us about that.
Well, the children have run ahead, and he turns and smiles at Elizabeth, you know, or grins or smirks. That's the last thing she sees. And then he shuts the door. And she hears him say, "I have a surprise for you, Charlie." And then she pounds on the door. She says, "Josh, you have to let me in." "Josh, you have to let me in." She can smell, you know, gasoline. And so not natural gas, but gasoline. And she her phone is in the car. So when he won't open the door and it's locked, she goes to her car, which is in the driveway, and gets her phone. The first thing she does is call her office, and she's instructed to call 911. And at some point, she also knows to move her car, because if something's going to happen. So she gets her car out of the driveway. She calls 911, and that call and a transcript of that call is easy to find on YouTube or anywhere on the internet. It's just harrowing because, you know, she gets a gentleman who, I forget how many years he'd been on the job, but, you know, he wasn't new. And he, you know, she tries to explain what's going on. She's been locked out of this house during a custody visit, and she smells gasoline. And, you know, it's hard to read and hear because we think of, you know, how could he be so stupid? He's asking her, what color is your car? What is your license plate? You know, what are you? Who are you? What are you doing there? And then he actually tells her, I'm sorry, lady, but, you know, we have to respond to emergency calls first. And she says, this is a life and death emergency. And he's still asking, you know, various questions and says that he'll send, and eventually we can hear a fire truck in the background. It goes on for, it seems forever, but I believe it's at least 3 minutes. And and I don't think she's still on the phone with him when the house explodes, but it explodes pretty quickly. And he gave an interview later that, of course, that was just the worst experience. And he, you know, he was following protocol. And he said he did know, you know, she was telling him, Elizabeth was telling him, you know, this is Josh Powell, who's a suspect in his wife's disappearance. And he said later he knew who Josh Powell was, but it just didn't register, you know, with what she was telling him. And, you know, as you can probably tell, I mean, I have sympathy for people who were caught in this. I mean, nobody is responsible except for Josh Powell.
No.
But,
absolutely.
You know, if my sympathy shows through, well, you know, so be it. I think it was terrible, terrible set of circumstances. And, you know, I know that Elizabeth, I don't know if she ever went back to work. I don't think she went back to work full time. But she or her supervisor told me later she no longer takes, you know, the hard cases. She had a PhD and was, you know, the most qualified person you could think of to do, you know, to be a caseworker on something like this. But, you know, who could have thought of the terror that Josh planned for that day? The house exploded. She was there. You know, the police and fire units arrived, and the house was you know, burned to the ground pretty much. Some of the frame was still there. So I'd been watching this story for a few years, kind of, you know, hoping Susan would be found or there'd be some kind of an ending. Publishers like endings. You know, the story still doesn't have an ending, but I was driving on a freeway in Seattle when I heard on the radio that the house had exploded and burned, and I thought I was going to drive off the road. And then to realize, and then to find out that it was planned. It wasn't some accident. So I went to the house the next day and I started working on the story and went to see, because, you know, you have to go there. You have to go to the scene of all these things. And already there were, you know, purple ribbons on the fence around the house. Purple was Susan's favorite color. And and it was just a terrifying day. And to think that, unfortunately, this jury, you know, agreed that with a lot of people and with Susan's family, that this could have been prevented. This could have been prevented if the state had paid attention more to Josh and the threat he presented and the threat to his children.
Yeah. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, we talked about that there was only one real person responsible, the dispatcher that basically hung up, and then she had to call another dispatcher to tell her about now the building, the home, the rented home was with the three people in it, the two children that were in her care occasionally or lately. But the thing is that police believed that Josh's father had something to do with this particular disappearance, and also Josh's brother. It was fascinating, the investigation that the police try to endeavor to connect Steve and to connect brother Mike with this. Tell us a little bit about this endeavor to try to do that and what it results with in terms of criminal charges for Steve and what happens to brother Mike.
You know, this is something that I think everybody's still trying to sort out. And, you know, Susan, the case of Susan's disappearance in Utah is closed. That was closed in 2013. But there have been some private searches for her, and there's some people, investigators, that, you know, help Chuck. And basically they've tried to chart where did Josh drive during that 24 hours he had the rental car. Well, they know the rental car, that they know he drove 800 miles. So they look closely at, you know, where would he have gone if it was 400 miles in one direction and the 400 miles back to leave the car at the airport. And not until after Josh and the kids were dead, did they find out more about both Steve and his brother Mike's, you know, where they were during that period of time. You know, it's easy to assume that, you know, when we found out so much about Steve and, you know, what a creep he was, and how he, when Susan and Josh had, you know, he was sexually obsessed with his daughter-in-law. He, you know, I read every page of his, I think it's a 20,000-page journal that Steve had kept over the years. And it reminds me of what a, you know, really naive, immature juvenile would write, because it was all about his obsession with Susan. And he wrote that he thought, you know, she'd divorce Josh and he would marry her and raise the kids. And, but, you know, we know he followed her. Steve followed her around Puyallup with his camera when she wasn't looking, and, you know, liked to take pictures of her and her legs, and, you know, saved her tampons when she was living in his house. Just all kinds of really creepy stuff. So it was easy, you know, to think that maybe he had some role in her disappearance, although, to me, that would be the opposite of Steve's behavior. He was so, you know, obsessed with her. I've never really thought that he would have helped get rid of her. And, in fact, they eventually proved that he, you know, was in Washington State the day she disappeared in Utah.
Right.
Some people still challenge that, but there's absolutely no evidence. And then we found out later in 2013 that Michael, Josh's brother, who was a graduate student in Minnesota, but often lived, again, you know, there's Steve Powell's home in Puyallup, Washington, where he's grown kids, you know, except for one daughter who, you know, escaped to a more normal life. Most of his adult children live there off and on all the time, and it's just kind of a really weird place. But Mike was in, usually in either Puyallup or in Minnesota later. But an investigator happened to be at a salvage yard in Oregon when the salvage yard, you know, where abandoned cars are, got a phone call from somebody in Minnesota. Well, it was Michael Powell, wondering if his car was still there that he'd left there a couple of years before. And here's this investigator standing there. I mean, it's really freaky coincidental. And
sure.
So Utah police now know that Mike Powell had probably helped Josh in some way get rid of Susan. And on his way there, so there's a route for the listeners who maybe don't know the western half of the United States very well. Utah is huge landmass, and one of the things they looked at were abandoned mines in Utah. Well, there are 10,000 abandoned mines in Utah. Some are boarded up, some aren't. But then there's a route, a northern route, where you could drive from Salt Lake City to Puyallup, Washington, on kind of a straight path. And
right.
This town where the salvage yard was on that path. And so then the thinking became, okay, Josh put Susan somewhere on the night that he took her and the boys out in the van. But then a couple days later, he moved her body, and his brother helped him move the body. And so she must have been in this rental car, or maybe not. I don't think they ever looked for DNA or found DNA in the rental car. But
right.
When they finally took dogs to the salvage yard where Mike's car was, the dogs alerted on his car. They didn't find specifically her DNA, but they did alert to there having been a corpse in
mm-hmm.
the body. And so the police then, Utah police, go to visit Michael Powell in Minnesota, where he's a graduate student, and they've questioned him before, of course, and he's very much his brother's defender. Well, by now his brother's dead, but he still is his brother's defender, and they let him know that they have his car. And almost a year to the date that Josh died and killed the kids, Michael Powell jumps off a building in Minnesota and commits suicide. And so that's, you know, it's clear that he helped. And so now they've done some searches along that road. That is a different part of Utah and Idaho, incidentally, than where Josh said he'd gone winter camping with the kids, which was more southwest Utah, and where they did their original searches. So it's really interesting. I found email, a memo about when they went to tell Steve. So Steve Powell by now was in prison for child pornography or voyeurism, and they went to tell him, first of all, that, you know, that Josh and the boys were dead, and then a year later about his son Michael. And his visible response to them, the only reaction they saw was anger.
Yeah.
You know, he seemed cranky for a few days, and that was sort of his reaction. And so he also had defended Josh, you know, to the very end. And I'm one of the few people that think that Steve Powell wasn't really clued in, or not that he, you know, we know he wasn't in Utah the day Susan disappeared, but his sons, they knew he had a big mouth, and they must have known he wrote everything down. I don't think they ever told him what really happened. I have a hunch that he didn't know where Susan was, and that, you know, he didn't really know what his sons had done, because I don't think they trusted him. So then
it's
Steve
interesting.
Powell died. Yeah. When he died, when Steve Powell died of a heart attack a couple of years ago, everybody thought, oh, you know, the last person has taken the secrets to, you know, his grave. But I just have a feeling he didn't know where Susan was.
You say that you don't believe he had any idea, but police thought it was interesting, more than interesting, that he had so many conversations with his son around that time, around the disappearance and before. And you also write, which is very interesting, is Steve's personal family history, which seems to have these eerie parallels. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about that as well.
Well, you're right. Those are very interesting kind of sidelights to this, is that in the last few days before Susan disappeared, Josh spent most of his time those last few years in the basement of their house in West Valley City, Utah, you know, on his computers and on his phones. And he talked to his father several times, and even on the day she disappeared, he called for a pancake recipe. You know, Susan's friends always responded, well, who needs a recipe for pancakes? And, you know, Josh never, ever cooked. He never did anything. And he, you know, his fight for custody of those boys wasn't out of love. It was out of power.
Right.
He wanted to win. He wanted to win. Mm-hmm. He wanted to have them and win. And beat, you know, Susan's parents, you know, and win this. But he did talk to his father a lot, and it'd be nice to know or interesting to know more about. I just don't think Steve was saying, well, here's how you could get rid of her, but you know, maybe we'll find out someday. I don't know how. But one of the things I learned doing this book, Dan, that I now is a part of everything and everything I write, everything I research, is how important family history is. You know, people like Josh are not, you know, they are raised, and they're raised by people who are also, you know, troubled. And when I looked at the family history of the Powells, I mean, it was really, it was almost inevitable, you'd think, inevitable, that Josh would be dangerously troubled. Steve Powell, as a child, I think he had one or two siblings, and they were completely, you know, moved around and tossed around all the time between their divorced parents and their grandparents. And this was in the Pacific Northwest. And, no real security. And Steve was punished, you know, I believe, you know, hit by his grandparents once when they found out that he had told other children that he'd been, you know, taken away from one parent. And I guess his grandparents said, you're never going to see your mother again, or something like that. And but they were, you know, secrets are a part of this story, and they're a part of this terrible family dysfunction. And so he grew up with a lot of, you know, instability. And but Steve was, you know, he was raised Mormon, and he actually went on a mission to South America. You know, his children by that time, Steve's children, never participated in that part of the Mormon, you know, in your young years when you go on a mission.
Right.
But he had, and he married his wife Terry, was, you know, a good Mormon, and they you know, seemed to have the start of a kind of average life. And then we know, you know, so one thing that I said Chuck was such a great investigator. So he drove to Spokane one day, and he was able to get a copy of the divorce records between Steve Powell and his wife, which mm-hmm. were from the early 1990s, I believe it was. So that was fascinating background for me because their childhood was, you know, they were going through a custody battle with their children, five children, Steve and his wife, in the early 90s. And so Terry, his wife, is, you know, of course, including every negative thing she can say about Steve, and Steve is saying, you know, things about her, but she also includes quite a bit about the children, how the children were afraid of Steve, how much he worked to, you know, make his children pick sides.
Right.
And wanted them to live with him. There was the one daughter was old enough that she could, you know, get out of the house when her parents were divorcing. Another daughter told her mother she was afraid to, you know, spend the weekend at Steve's, that her brothers, you know, had stripped her naked and touched her one day against her will and all kinds of things. Also in that divorce document, things about Josh's childhood, pulling a knife on his mother once and threatening her. And there's another brother who, you know, had made nooses and you know, weird, violent drawings. And it was, and he turned, Steve turned his children against their mother,
yeah.
except for one of the daughters. And, you know, we had a joke that Steve's house in Puyallup was Fort Powell. We called it Fort Powell because
yeah.
that's where he and the kids, you know. And for a while, you know, Charlie and Braden were part of that. But somebody that I have interviewed over the years, who is a psychiatrist and did a lot of work interviewing serial killers to find out more about their childhoods. She told me that she never met a killer or a serial killer that didn't have a very disruptive childhood and was not abused themselves as children.
Mm-hmm. Let's stop for a second just for these messages. Now, we talked about Steve, but the most dramatic thing, I think, and it relates to the title of this book as well, something that Steve had told his children 20 years before regarding when people can't stay together. If you like, I could read it, but can you tell us what he essentially said?
Yeah, what did you say you could read it?
Yeah, you just said Steve had told his that sometimes people can't let go and murder a loved one.
Uh-huh. Isn't that to think of a parent telling their children, and I think they were teenagers. This was at the time mm-hmm. of the divorce, I believe, that
yeah.
he said, you know, sometimes you can't let go. You know, want to get even, and if I can't have you, you know, nobody can have you.
Yeah, incredible. What now? We talked about you talk about the incredible effort that Chuck Cox and Judy, but Chuck especially, can't let this go. So he, as you write, he's still searching for his daughter. He is still investigating. He can't let this go, can he?
Well, no, he can't. And yet, I want to say they are, you know, they're people with a strong faith. And it's really easy to admire them and respect them. And they participate, you know, in any you know, television coverage of this or local coverage. You know, they are there all the time. They're there when there's anything in court. And yet, you know, they have other children. They have grandchildren. They have their church. They somehow have found a balance and not an acceptance, but they find a way to go on. And I mean, I just, you know, seen and witnessed and heard Chuck over the years, and he has, you know, told me stories that, well, one of them was that the day after the fire, the police chief of West Valley City, where Susan had disappeared, came to Puyallup, and he and Chuck sat in the car across from where their house had been that had exploded. This is just the day after the fire. And Chuck told me that Maxwell cried and told Chuck, you know, you were right. You were right to warn us. You were right. Josh was going to do something. But I never saw. I've seen Chuck, you know, tear up, particularly in the early days when she was missing. But there's a, you know, there's a real strength to him that he, I believe that he believes that they may never know what happened to Susan, but he just kind of keeps looking. I think it's been a few years now since they've actually done a search, but they've got a couple people that kind of helped them and have done have continued to try to investigate some things. And this, I think this trial for the wrongful death suit, there was an awful lot that came out because of that. And I think there's some things they're still looking at. I know the FBI has never been able to really get into both Michael and Josh's computers, because the two of them were doing an awful lot of back and forth at the time Susan disappeared, and then, of course, afterwards. And they just can't seem to crack that.
Is there a reason why they can't crack those computers? Is there something that Mike knew or did? Is there, because it seems when you only hear stories of that, of somebody being some sort of a computer expert, or at least gaining somebody's expertise to be able to wipe out records.
Well, I guess it was Josh, and you know, he was. I don't think of him as particularly bright, but he had, you know, spent his time with computers, and apparently, I mean, they've even sent the computers to the company that makes the software that they used to block things, and they haven't been able to crack it. So I think it was just, I have a feeling it's just many, maybe a variety of different software programs that that hit it. But I'm really surprised that FBI experts haven't been able to find out, because, you know, I mean, potentially it would say where Susan is. I would imagine they discussed, well, you know, I left her, you know, maybe the next day, Josh told his brother, I left her here, or we have to go here to get her.
Right.
But I'm really, I've always been interested in where was she for that first day? You know, where was that? Because probably wasn't way out in the desert. If he then, with a rental car, you know, got her to move her, probably was some. It could have even been somewhere, you know, not far outside the city.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, too, that this Anne Bremner, she didn't buy into the idea that the prosecution couldn't prosecute this case, partly because of nobody and partly because of other difficulties. What was her take on that, and why did she believe, essentially, that they could have got a conviction?
Uh-huh. Well, she's one of my few heroes. She's helped other families with nobody cases, and in fact, I write about her quite a bit. So my new book is about Kyron Horman, who's the boy missing from his grade school in Portland, Oregon.
Right.
We just passed the 10-year anniversary of that case, and he hasn't been found. Her work with the Cox family happened at about the same time that Kyron disappeared. But Anne feels that, you know, as I said, prosecutors can drag their feet. I did find somebody who's kind of the expert in nobody cases, a former federal prosecutor who keeps track of nobody cases that are successfully prosecuted and without a body. But Anne really, really believed that, you know, she'll look at ways to get around this. And in this case, the fact that I think the thing that made the case for her was that here was an entity, being in the state of Washington, that was supposed to be doing a job protecting these kids. Now, in a lot of nobody cases, there is no entity like that to bring a wrongful death suit with. So,
right.
You know, that doesn't exist. But in this case, you know, somebody was supposed to be protecting those boys. And was there a chance that, in fact, there were errors committed? And there were. And it's really frightening to read the documents that even up until, even, you know, the week when Josh was told you're going to have to take a psychosexual exam and all of that, just the week before that, the kind of glowing reviews he got from not the caseworker, not Elizabeth, but from, you know, the people. She was, you know, employed by a private agency. Caseworkers often work for an agency that do that work. But how the state of Washington and CPS, you know, and they had interviews with him over the, you know, period of time and with the kids even a psychologist at one point just, you know, said Josh was fine, that Josh could be a loving parent.
Yeah.
So there were definitely red flags.
This as well was interesting too, because there was this pastor from his church, Tim Atkins.
Yeah.
So there was some plans I don't know if it was a form of counseling, but there were plans to meet with this Tim Atkins, and he would have been, or tried to be, an important person in this whole thing, this whole mess. Tell us a little bit more about his role.
Yeah. So Tim Atkins was a minister of a small conservative church group. He happened to be a neighbor of Steve Powell's. He, you know, knew about when the Josh and the boys arrived. And I think he just, you know, wanted to reach out and help if he could, because here's a man. I spent a lot of time with Tim and his family, and I think he was a bit naive, but meant well, and tried to offer, you know, friendship and fellowship to Josh. I think once or twice Josh and the boys went to Tim's church, but you know, Josh was really suspicious of churches and this hatred for the Mormons, you know, kind of ran his mind. Tim offered, you know, his home. And so sometimes Josh would have his custody visits there. The boys would play with Tim's kids, and they'd have a meal, you know, together. And I think Tim gave him a Bible. He, you know, prayed with Josh, or wanted to pray with Josh, or made Josh pray with him. Definitely meant well. And on the Sunday that the house exploded, I'm trying to remember if Tim, how he exactly got the word. Of course, it was on television here and radio.
Mm-hmm.
But he went across the street to Steve's house, and Josh's sister, Alina, was there alone, I think, and sat at the table with her, and she'd gotten one of the goodbye texts from Josh, so I know he was, you know, reaching out to the family then. I think so many people underestimated Josh. So many, I think, starting with the West LA City Police, and then, you know, most of the people who crossed paths with him and here in Washington State, they just underestimated what he was capable of.
You write about a person named Alina or Alina.
Alina, uh-huh.
And her strange support of her brother and her father, and the things that she went and did in order to try to rehabilitate their reputations, I guess, through a website. Tell us a little bit about her feelings about all of this and her allegiances.
Well, Alina was Josh's younger sister, and in her 20s, though, when all of this occurred, and we spent some time with her. She wouldn't go on the record. She's given a few interviews, but she was the younger sister who, you know, is mentioned in the divorce documents that said she didn't feel safe, you know, staying at her father's house. She didn't want to shower while she was staying at her father's house, and she was maybe 10 years old. But by the time she was, grown, she had also been brainwashed by Steve Powell. And I don't think, you know, I'm not using that term lightly. He brainwashed those kids, and it was kind of like, you know, them against the world, Fort Powell against the world. Mm-hmm. So she was living there, and, you know, Josh took every advantage of her he could. Josh didn't know how to be a father, take care of his kids. So when he and the boys, you know, moved back after Susan disappeared, she would, you know, watch the children. And I think Josh paid her a little bit to do that. Most of these people are never working also. They just live at their father's house. And she was very defensive of Josh, and even, you know, it caused a split between her and her older sister, who was, you know, the normal healthy one that was living in Utah with her family. Alina, you know, chose sides. And so one of the things was this website that there were a couple of websites. Josh wanted to start one soon after Susan disappeared and actually sat on a sofa at her friend's house in Utah to try to build one. And then he, of course, moved back to Puyallup, and the website very quickly became not about who Susan is or was or her disappearance. It became about Josh and Steve's theories about what happened to Susan. And there was a man in Utah who disappeared, I believe it's just a few weeks before Susan, and they glommed on the bat and decided that she'd run away with this guy. And he's never been found. But, you know, that's not Susan. They were just, you know, no chance. And but they would you know, try to promote these theories that she'd run off and left her children, and that every theory they could think of that Susan, to besmirch Susan and her reputation, to say she's not the woman you thought, she's not the mother you thought, you know. And Alina participated in that, and then later she started her own website, I think, and put up a bunch of old family videos that she thought, oh, I know what they were. They showed that Susan used to be friendly with Steve. And so to try to dismiss that argument that Susan was always suspicious of Steve, that's why she and Josh moved to Utah, was to get away from Steve. Well, here's a family photo of Susan smiling with Steve in his presence. And so doesn't that prove Susan isn't who we thought she was? You know, it got nasty. It really did.
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing, too, so much of the vivid, almost cinematic scenes in this book. The blue casket, the one casket for the two boys, Charlie and Braden, the 2,000 mourners at the funeral, people from coming up from out of state to come, strangers mostly attending this, to come. This resonating with so many people throughout America and still, and so many people throughout the world. The searches on foot, horseback, air, water, underwater, exhaustive searches, many searches, searches of property. This case has captivated the imagination of people, and it won't let go. There's people messaged me, said that they were obsessed with this case. There's so many responses from this.
Well, I think it is, you know, there's not always a mystery with every crime.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are always questions to be answered. You know, why did this happen?
Sure.
And often the crime is, well, I guess Christie used to say, the crime is the end of the story. And really, there's so much that comes before. You know, who are these people? Why did this happen? I always like to say it's important to know in what community did this crime happen. That tells you a lot about the people. But in this case, the crime is not the end of the story. And there are several mysteries still a part of this. And I think, like we mentioned the JonBenet case, I think it's those cases that forever haunt us, like Natalie Holloway, who's never been found. And who killed JonBenet Ramsey? Where is Susan Powell? You know, those kinds of mysteries that go unsolved. I think it's very intriguing. I think, especially with this case, we learn a little bit more. You know, every once in a while, there's, I don't believe in the word closure. I just don't think.
No.
You know, there's no one day. You know, when they won the jury award, you know, several weeks ago, I don't think the Coxes said, "Boy, that's over with." You know, or at least that's done. No, it's not like that. And even if Josh had been arrested, or you know, it just that I don't think you wake up and one day and then there's closure. But I think you learn to live with a tragedy. And I think the lucky ones find some way to learn to live with it. And then there are people that can't or don't learn that. But it's still quite a mystery, and I know everybody would like to know, where's Susan?
Yeah. It's incredible, too, the bedroom that the Coxes built for to house the two boys.
Mm-hmm.
And like they said, they were like little animals. They had to be, you know, socialized, basically, to get along and
yeah.
to be able to live in this home.
Yeah.
And as we mentioned before, there was the dark circles under their eyes. They had lost a lot of weight.
Yeah.
Just before,
yeah.
the night before, they had mentioned before they didn't want to go with their daddy before, but especially were
yeah.
hesitant and mentioned, Braden mentioned, I don't want to see daddy. I want to stay here. So they were very adamant that day. So much heartbreaking. Again, no one could know, no one could predict, no one could prevent what happened. And then, despite Chuck Cox and Judy, their fears that this, especially once he had that psychosexual evaluation and knew that he wasn't going to get custody of the kids, that he was to be feared, and certainly that horror came true. Just a incredibly fascinating.
I think it's human nature to second guess yourself and to let something like the fact that the boys begged not to go that day. I mean, I would never be able to forget that. But
yeah.
you know, the Coxes are, you know, they've just resolved to, you know, focus on what they can do. Not anything they can change. They can't change now.
Yeah,
and what, you know, I mean, that happens all the time with children. You know, and it's not going to be, you don't know they're going to their death. You know, I know Elizabeth Griffin Hall, the social worker, the caseworker, told me, I mean, she drove them to their death. And,
yeah.
you know, but the Coxes seem to be able to focus on, you know, what can they do now? What can they do? And I really want to make sure I add something about what this means for other states. And even before the wrongful death reward award, sometime after Charlie and Braden's death, a state legislator here proposed a law that would say that if you're even a person of interest in your spouse's death or disappearance, that you
sure.
you can't have custody of your children. That
yeah.
that didn't go anywhere, and I never found out why that didn't really go anywhere in the legislature. Maybe it's too broad.
Right.
But I think that it's something for states to pay attention to, and especially after this, multi-million-dollar wrongful death suit, that how do you handle custody issues and custodial visits when there's been a crime committed? And, you know, I believe that with Josh, he should have, his only custody visits should have been, you know, in an environment where there was security, at least, and some kind of controlled environment. But, you know, it wasn't in the office building where a number of other parents had their visits, where there
right.
was staff and everything. They didn't, you know, they were talked into allowing him to be at the pastor's home and then at this rental house. But maybe if states were stricter about where do custody visits, where can they take place, and how do we really protect children from our worst possible scenario? I really think that's something that could be, you know, something that could be done, that could come out of all of this. And for states to pay new attention to people who are having custody visits who are under suspicion, They might be innocent, but they haven't been cleared. And how do you create a secure environment during those custody visits if there's, you know, they're still allowed to see their children?
Yeah. I think a combination of the two things, the case itself and the details, but also even more importantly, this lawsuit will be somewhat of a deterrent, I think, if other states and jurisdictions realize that they maybe have to pony up an incredible decision, financial decision like this, of $30-something million. So hopefully they will learn from this that person. And because we have seen people take out their frustrations and their desperation and kill their children. So this is not the first time at all.
Yeah, I mean, it is not unusual. You know, it's familial homicide when a person kills their spouse and themselves and their children, their whole family. And I think it's one of the, you know, most tragic sorts of murders. And, you know, to kill your children, you know, but you know, the Coxes knew that you know, they're the only ones who didn't underestimate Josh. They never did for a minute. They always thought he was capable of the worst, and you know, really nobody believed them except maybe, you know, Ann Bremner and a few people. But you know, he was just, you know, his anger at them, at the church, at, you know, at Susan, you know, and you just think, you know, when I gave talks on this book, and I still do, but when I'd give a talk at a library in Seattle, and you know, I sort of adopted the, you know, the New York City transit system saying, if you see something, say something. You know, because Susan's friends knew that Josh was, you know, this was a domestic dispute. This is domestic violence.
Yeah.
It was a case of domestic violence. And they knew that he was treating her badly. And they knew that she was afraid something would happen. Because she wrote, you know, she wrote a handwritten will that she put in her safety deposit box saying, if anything happens to me, you know, look at Josh. It wasn't an accident. If anything happens to me, it wasn't an accident. Mm-hmm. Then she did a video, you know, diary of all their belongings. So, and she says on the beginning of that, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm documenting our life right now. And I wish, the other thing I wish is that people had, you know, somebody had convinced her to leave. One of her sisters really said, Susan, I'll drive down there right now and get you and the boys. But for many reasons, she didn't leave Josh. Because he threatened her. He told her, you know, you'll never see the boys.
Yeah.
But, you know, women used to come up to me and say, you know, if I told my daughter to, you know, get out, to leave her husband, she'd never talk to me again. You know, and these were parents who said, you know, they felt their children were in, you know, potential domestic violence situations. So saying, if you see something, say something, isn't always, you know, sometimes your children aren't going to want to hear that. But but there's, you know, so many angles to this story, and the custody situation and the domestic violence situation, and it just kind of goes on and on.
It's very interesting that this is many times, especially recently, that there are people that are rather kill than divorce. Just because somehow that would be harmful to their religious reputation, or they would look unfavorable in their own with other members of the church. So I think it's just, again, incredible that somebody would consider murder rather than divorce. And in this particular case, rather than not have custody of their children, full custody of their children, not just visitations. They decided to slaughter their children in such a dramatic way. I want to thank you so much.
I think often it's getting even, too.
Yeah, it's revenge.
It's revenge. I read these cases about, you know, when couples split and the dad kills himself and the kids because it's revenge to his wife, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about If I Can't Have You, the update, Susan Powell, her mysterious disappearance, and the murder of her children. Thank you so much, Rebecca Morris. For those that might want to check this out, do you have a website? And tell us how they might take a look at this book.
Sure. My website is RebeccaTMorris, M-O-R-R-I-S, .com. RebeccaTMorris.com is the website. I'd love to hear from people. There's a way to contact me through that. I'm also on Facebook, Rebecca Morris. And the book, If I Can't Have You, is it's been paperback for years. It was originally hardcover. It's a paperback. It's an audio book. It's an e-book. And all the usual places, which are kind of narrowed right now, but with stores closed. But it's always there, of course, on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other sites like that. And as you mentioned before, the subject of a 2020 program this Friday, unless we're reporting, civil unrest in the United States after the election, who knows?
Yeah.
It could get bumped, but it'll air, and so that everybody can watch, look at the 2020 website too, or my website for information about the show.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Rebecca Morris. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Dan,
If I Can't Have You. Thank you so much. You have a great evening.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.